Let's get started. I think. Good morning, everybody. Thanks for joining us. For those of you that don't know me, my name is Peter. I'm a partner with NPM Legal. We're a specialist employment and business immigration practice based in the south of England, but we work with companies that are based all over the world. They have a common interest, which is employing people here in the UK, and that's where we help them. Delighted as ever to be joined by my wonderful colleague, Adrienne, and her soggy trainer, Adrienne. That's not going to make an awful lot of sense to people who weren't here for the first 10 seconds of the call, but it's related to the fine British weather
No.
we have at the moment.
Yes.
Just a couple of housekeeping points. We've obviously got the chat function down at the bottom, so that gives you the ability just to comment generally, and everybody has visibility of that. If you want to ask us any questions on today's session, please do use the Q&A function. If you're joining us live, then just a fantastic way to pick our brains while we're here, and we'd absolutely love to hear from you. We'll just deal with them as they pop up. So by all means, use the Q&A for questions. Obviously, if you're listening to us on Spotify or Amazon Music, then you don't have the privilege of being able to ask us questions live. So you just have to listen out and see what we respond to during the course of that. Just a reminder for everybody, we've got a bunch
Or
of
ping us an email.
episodes, or you can email us, exactly.
Yeah, just saying.
Bunch of back episodes on Spotify and Amazon Music. So yeah, please do go back if you want some easy listening about employment law and business immigration. What are we talking about today? Today we're talking about dismissal and re-engagement, colloquially known as fire and rehire. A couple of reasons for that. First of all, a new draft code, or an updated draft code of practice on it, has been published now by the government. It's going before Parliament on the 1st of March, I think, for a second reading. So we're expecting this to be adopted into law very soon. The other reason is we're just seeing quite a lot of business change processes at the moment. I know, since the start of the year in particular, we've been pretty busy in terms of supporting on a few different business change exercises. Now, that unfortunately involves redundancy and headcount reductions, but it's also involving changes to terms and conditions of employment as well. And obviously, that's very much wrapped in to this concept of dismissal and re-engagement. So we thought it was just timely, really, to go over a few of the basics in terms of what we mean by it, and then just talk a bit about this new code of practice as well. So since, well, first of all, just defining what fire and rehire is for those of you that might not be fully familiar with it. It's basically the practice of dismissing workers and then re-engaging on new terms and conditions of employment, or threatening to do that as part of negotiations on changes to terms and conditions of employment. And really, there was a bit of a trend since the pandemic of this becoming a little bit more prevalent. I mean, the main one that was reported in the media was the P&O debacle. But I suppose accurately, that was more of just the fire, and there wasn't the rehire part, because obviously they dismissed at a stroke a whole bunch of permanently employed workers. And then they were looking to replace them, I think, with agency workers. So there wasn't the rehire part of those same employees. But I mean, when you look in the media about what's been reported in terms of using these tactics, BA have been in the firing line, British Gas, Go North West, the Northern Bus Company, Tesco as well, I think, have been reported as well. So it's been a bit more in the public eye, and it's been on the government's radar as a result. Now, way back in January 2023, there was a draft code of practice about using fire and rehire, which the government was consulting on. I mean, I was quite surprised to see, when I was just prepping for today's session, that there were only 50 consultation responses. And I know I will quite often post on LinkedIn, or in these sessions, we'll talk about the fact that there's a government consultation about one thing or another. But 50, I mean, 8 of those were individual consultation responses, Adrienne. So 42
Yeah.
from, business, maybe employment lawyers,
Trade
maybe interested
unions.
parties, trade unions, of course. It struck me as being quite a low number, right?
Yeah, no, I was surprised at that as well. It makes me wonder whether, in actual fact, everybody got very hot under the collar when they saw the P&O stuff in the news. But in reality, how much of it is an issue? But
Yeah,
it's
maybe.
sufficient an issue for the government to have gone down this route of issuing the code of practice.
Yeah,
So,
fizzled out a little bit. I mean, CIPD's own
yeah.
research, I think, they surveyed 2,000 firms last year and reported 3% were kind of actively using this, which suggests quite a low number. But I mean, if you extrapolate that into the number of businesses, it's like 40,000, 42,000, I think. That's probably the scientific way of approaching it. Anyway, back to this code. What it's intended to do is just to give some practical guidance on how to avoid, manage, and resolve conflict and disputes. And that's what we're going to be talking about today. It doesn't create any new law. So there are no kind of staggering new legal principles as around of this. It's probably better described as a codification almost of good industrial practices, right? Bear in mind that at the moment, there's no standalone claim for not following the code, like there can be with some other codes of practices where the tribunal can look to the misapplication of a code or a failure to implement it and award an uplift tacked on to pre-existing claims. So what I'm talking about here is if somebody brings a claim that's in relation to a scenario where this code should have applied and an employer has failed to comply with it, then tribunal awards can be increased by up to 25%. But it works the other way. So if the party bringing the claim has also failed to comply with the code unreasonably, it's a 25% reduction in the award as well. I mean, that's very similar to what we see in other code.
Disciplinary.
Yeah, disciplinary is, of course, the main one we're thinking about. So we're expecting this code to come into force later this year. But what about the current legal situation, Adrian, when it comes to firing hat reality?
Well, as you said, it doesn't create any new law and it doesn't get rid of any existing law. So, under the current law, fire and rehire is legal. Right, there's already legal protections in place, wrongful dismissal, unfair dismissal, constructive dismissal, and the consultation requirements. And but the code is all of that stuff, all the consultation requirements is already set out in existing law under the Trade Union Labour Relations Act, and that's where this code would sit alongside it. But it's worth remembering that under the existing law, there is this wider definition of redundancy, which is why sometimes people are a bit surprised that, where you're changing terms and conditions and it's not redundancy, if it's affecting 20 or more employees in a period of 90 days, you are still required to go through the collective consultation requirements, which, can be a surprise to people. But that's where you need elected employee reps, or you need to consult with trade union reps if your business recognizes the union. That's meant to be with a view to reaching agreement. And then you've got the mandatory waiting period between the start of consultation and any termination of employment where you can't reach agreement. So that's the current laws. What does the draft code say? Well, nothing really, from as Peter has just said, that what should be good practice already. And I think as you rightly said, it's like codifying what people should be doing now. But I think one thing, I mean, there's a few things to note. The code applies regardless of the number of employees. So if you've got 60 people affected and you're following the collective consultation obligations, then the code applies. If you've got one employee and you want to consult with them over changes to their terms and conditions, and there is the potential to dismiss and re-engage, then the code will also apply. So, I think that's kind of a fairly critical point. But is it? I mean, does that really take you any further than if you were sitting down to do that and you were looking down the barrel of a potential unfair dismissal claim? Arguably not, but we can have that discussion in a bit. But I think in terms of where we are now, we've got a revised code, and there isn't really much that's changed from the first draft. The first draft required employers to contact ACAS if no agreement was with employees was reached, and they were going to fire and rehire. So that was, a requirement, but that's been strengthened a little bit because employers are now told that they should contact ACAS at an early stage before they raise fire and rehire with the workforce. So although it's not a mandatory requirement, it's going to be best practice to do so. And obviously, if there's a failure to do that, then that's likely to be a breach of the code and in relation to a linked claim that can give an uplift. Now, Peter and I were having a discussion this morning, weren't we, about, well, what does that mean? When do we contact ACAS? You know, when do we think about this?
It's probably worth just pausing there to just talk about kind of practically how this interfaces with an example of where it would all be engaged, because there's quite a few moving parts. And yeah, you're right. I mean, we were having this discussion this morning around, look, in reality, applying it to a situation, at what point as an employer are you actually going to get in touch with ACAS? Given that on the one hand, you're being told, well, you shouldn't be using fire and rehire as a negotiation tactic, and it should absolutely be a last resort if you can't agree something. But then on the other hand, you're also being told, well, if you're contemplating using fire and rehire, like if it's on the cards, then you should be talking about it to your employees from the start. And then you've got this requirement or this recommendation to go to ACAS before you go to the workforce. And I mean, if we think about a kind of an example of a scenario where all of this comes to life. So say you're an employer and you've got 50 employees and you want to change a fundamental term and condition in their contracts of employment. So ordinarily, you could go to those employees and say, hey, everybody, for these really good business reasons, we need to change this thing in your contract from A so it says B. Do you agree to it? Now, if all 50 or most of the 50 say, yeah, that's not a problem, I mean, you might incentivize them to make the change, but they agree to the change, there's no issue, right? Because it becomes a contractual variation by consent. The parties willingly agree to vary the contract in the same way as when people get pay rises, they agree to vary their contract to accept the higher salary than what's in their original employment contract. Where those TULCRA collective consultation rules kick in is if, as a fallback, the employer is thinking, well, we may be in a scenario where we might not reach agreement. And if we don't reach agreement, we might be contemplating dismissing some people and then re-engaging them under a new contract, which is identical to the old contract, apart from it has term B in it instead of term A. Now that,
or just dismissing them,
or just dismissing the P&O case, for example. Now that is going to engage all of those redundancy collective consultation rules, because there's a broader definition of what redundancy means in TULCRA versus in the Employment Rights Act. So that means you're then into the realms, because you're dealing with more than 20 employees, of running a collective consultation process. So engaging with the unions, if you have a recognised union, or dealing with employee representatives, because there's a legal duty to give affected employees the opportunity to nominate and elect employee reps. Now, bear in mind that even though you've got to follow these rules on collective consultation, if at the end of the process you're firing and rehiring, those dismissals at the end in the fire part are not necessarily, probably not going to be redundancy dismissals. And that's where there's sometimes a bit of confusion. You've got to follow the rules on collective redundancy, but the reason for dismissal at the end isn't actually redundancy, it's SOSR, so some other substantial reason, which is one of the fair reasons set out in the Employment Rights Act. So,
and that's because the job still exists. You just want it done on different terms, right? So that's why there's that's why it's still there.
But that's why
this is so confusing. Yeah,
and that's where I think this is a bit of a mishmash. I find it a little bit confusing, because at what point then are you going to introduce this idea of collective consultation? Because one approach in my example is, you go and consult with the employees about making this change, and that consultation process, it might take 2 months. At the end of the two-month period, if then you're saying, we haven't now got agreement, we now need to consider dismissal and re-engagement as a strategy, that means that you are contemplating making redundancies within the wider definition of TULCRA. So then what? You've got to start a formal collective redundancy consultation exercise, which is going to take another couple of months. We've talked about this already, Adrian, but
It stretches everything out, puts back your timetable, but also there's the point that the employees might turn around and go, well, you've already tried to get our consent informally. We said no. You're now saying you're going into collective consultation, which requires you to do it in good faith. But very clearly, you've made the decision that you're going ahead anyway. It's a bit of a sham. Why are you bothering? Exactly. I think in terms of the ACAS bit as well, is if you take the view that in order to not to stretch it out in your example, that you're going to go for collective anyway, then surely the employee reps and trade union reps are going to turn around and say, well, if you're going into collective, very clearly you're contemplating that if push comes to shove, you're going to dismiss and re-engage anyway. Oh, and by the way, have you notified ACAS? Have you spoken to ACAS about it? So there's a real question mark over some of the parts in the code, which A, requires you to contact ACAS, and B, requires you not to use fire and rehire as a threat when you're talking about negotiations. And yeah, we were talking this morning, it's like, well, if you have to be really clear that dismissal and re-engagement is contemplated if we can't reach agreement, how do you marry that against the prohibition on using it as a threat? Because by, you know, by virtue of just saying that's something that you're going to do, it's almost it is a threat, whether it's a low level threat or a high level threat, you know, P&O, which was, you know, sign or else, as opposed to we're going to consult in good faith. We really want to reach your agreement. We're going to be agile. We're going to be flexible. We're going to genuinely listen to all of your concerns, you know, all of that good stuff that you do during collective consultation. How do you marry that against the, but actually when push comes to shove, if you don't agree with what we say, we're going to fire you and offer you the new terms anyway.
Yeah. It's, I mean, a because a sort of approach that we've taken before is, you know, we've seen businesses say, well, we have the absolute best intentions of running a meaningful consultation process. We want to try and look after people. But as an ultimate last resort, we may have to dismiss or re-engage. But we don't really want to do that. We want to try and get agreement first. But because the employer doesn't know, it doesn't have any sense of how many people may say no to the changes, and therefore whether it's maybe more than 20 people they're contemplating firing, dismissing before they re-engage, they take an approach of running collective from the start, even though this, you know, this option is the least desirable option in the background. Well, what does this mean now that you're not supposed to run it as a collective because you're not supposed to be so transparent in terms of that being the ultimate option, or you just build it into a much longer time frame for consultation? Probably.
Yeah. I don't know. I think we probably differ. I think you're going to have to be really clear, and a business is going to have to be really clear. What if push comes to shove, are they going to end up with this as being a potential option, or will it be a case that if they can't get agreement with some of the workforce, they'll just let it lie? And they'll do it by natural wastage, or they'll do it by other means. You know, you can change someone's T's and C's in a different way. Like if they're promoted, you change their role, then obviously you can issue them a new contract at that time. So I think that decision-making process up front is important. And then I think, to be honest, it's just a question of, we're going to have to see how this is interpreted by the tribunal judges when it comes to claims. And if employees then bring unfair dismissal claims and say, I was, you know, I'm complaining about my dismissal, which I was told was SOSR, but here's all the breaches of the ACAS code. And my God, there's a lot of things to pick through, aren't there? So,
yeah,
you know, but it's the uplift. So,
I'm going to talk about the information that needs to be provided by an employer as part of this information and consultation process. But we've had a question from Chris just saying, or asking, is contacting ACAS regardless of the number of employees? And the answer is yes, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I'm wondering how ACAS are going to react to this, because obviously I've been dealing with them on early conciliation, and I don't know what everyone else's experiences are. It's very often you get an email back going, we're supremely busy, we may not be able to get to you. And on occasions, the first contact that we've had through ACAS under, you know, in the 6 week conciliation period is probably about week four. So I feel rather sorry for ACAS, but yes, to answer the question, according to the code, there's no sort of exception for a limited number of employees, so it would apply.
Okay. So in terms of the information that you're expected to provide in these dismissal and re-engagement scenarios, we know from the revised code that the recommendation is that information is provided in writing. I mean, that's pretty common sense recommendation anyway. And for those of you that are regular joiners to these sessions, you'll know that we talk a lot about creating a paper trail in terms of certain situations, just because it's transparent. You've got a touch point, something to reference back. So we'd recommend that anyway, but that's what the code says. So information is provided in writing. And the early time frame is really designed to promote meaningful consultation. So the parties have got as much time as possible just to reflect on what's going on and talk about alternative proposals and try and come up with solutions and mitigation options. In terms of what information to share, the code talks about sharing as much information as possible to help with the consultation, and makes the point that the more information that you can share with your employees, generally the more productive the consultation process will be, and therefore the more likely that you're going to reach an agreed outcome. So, bearing in mind with consultation exercises, generally, there's no obligation to reach an actual agreement at the end of it. They're typically couched in terms of trying to do your best to reach agreement. I think there's a recognition that commercially, sometimes that's just not viable. So things you might be giving, what the proposed changes are, what's going to be affected by the, who's going to be affected, sorry, by the proposed changes, what the business reasons underpinning them are, what the timings are for the introduction, any other steps that have been considered, and generally what's going to happen next. You are allowed to withhold commercially sensitive information. Now, a lot of you may be sitting listening to that and thinking, well, hey, that sounds an awful lot like regular redundancy consultation or collective redundancy consultation. Think about your section 188 TILCRA requirements in terms of the information that you've got to provide to the unions or the employee reps. Yeah, it's kind of synonymous with all of that, really, isn't it? The echoes of all of that.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is the point to remember, is that a lot of the time, you know, good HR practices are going to be doing this anyway. So this is designed to catch those people who don't do it. Coming back to that codification point, but I think that bit about sharing information, there's always that sort of fine line in terms of being transparent enough to enable meaningful consultation. So basically, it's all about taking the reps and the employees on the journey with you, so that they can see why the changes are being made. Because if they can understand it, you're going to find it an awful lot easier to get agreement. But then equally, the fine line comes in, because you don't want to tell them too much that might then get out into the marketplace or get to the ears of customers and, you know, and competitors, etc. So, you know, it's making that judgment call about what to disclose. Consultation. So, you know, this is a really difficult one, because let's face it, a lot of the time businesses have probably worked out where they need to land, and the consultation is going to be about taking the right steps, engaging with the workforce, etc., all the rest of it. But ultimately, there's a decision that has normally been made. But I think it's always good to remember, and again, it's still existing law, that consultation is not just a question of following the right procedure. And we see it quite often when we try and map out timelines, and we get asked questions like, how many meetings do you think we'll need? It's like, well, consultation needs to be meaningful. So it may be one or two, it may be three, four, five, six, seven, because frankly, it just depends on how much information you're going to give, what engagement you get with people. And it's about that openness and engagement and doing it in good faith. And just because you have a decision, an endpoint, and where you want to go, doesn't mean that consultation is a sham, because consultation is about what can you do to mitigate the impact. You know, what about phasing in proposals, which is one of the new things that's recommended in the code. So you might say, instead of it goes from black to white, the changes will take effect bang on this date, it might be, we're going to phase this in over a period of 3 to 6 months, and we're going to do this, and we're going to do that, and we're going to talk to you, and we're going to monitor it. You know, it's that type of collaborative thinking and discussions with the workforce, whilst being as clear as possible about your proposals.
And it's an exchange of information as well, isn't it? I mean, that's the thing. It's not just kind of one-sided broadcasting information. That's the information part of it, but it's the consultation is the exchange of views, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And you know, it may well be that the workforce comes up with some really good ideas that might not ultimately change your end proposal, but might change how you get there, might change how it's delivered. So, you know, it's this is what this whole consultation process is meant to be, is the two-way exchange of information. Yeah, I kind of talked about that, about the time frame, and one of the things that the code is mentioning is not being in a rush to go through consultation. It should be as long as it can be to allow a more in-depth discussion and a deeper understanding of the rationale for proposals. And that kind of ties back into how transparent are you going to be with the provision of your information. But yeah, threat of dismissal, it's you've got to just be so careful in terms of using that as a threat of a, you know, well, if you don't agree to this, we're going to dismiss anyway, because that's what we need to do, against the ultimately, you know, we've reached the end of the road, we've discussed this, these are the concessions we've made, these are the points that you've made, we still aren't at that point where we can reach agreement, but for all of these business reasons, we're looking like we're going to have to go down the route of ending contracts and re-engaging on new terms.
So in relation to that then, I mean, is it worth just speaking about, if you can't reach agreement, what that looks like, you know, kind of fast forwarding to the end of that part?
Because
you know, you're in a scenario, aren't you, where you're looking at, as an employer, unilaterally making the changes, right?
Well, you can't you? So you can unilaterally make the change where you just go, we're just going to impose it anyway. So you're not dismissing, you're just going, from X date, this is going to apply to you. Mm. And then the employee's obviously got a few choices. They can either resign and go for constructive dismissal, remembering mm-hmm. that they still have to follow the processes. So we're talking grievances, more time and money spent in a business, or they can choose to work under protest. They can say, I'm really unhappy about this. I don't like the way you've behaved. I'm going to raise a grievance, but I'm going to carry on working because, frankly, I still need to be paid for the job I'm doing. And on that one there, it's always a risk for the employee, because if they carry on working under protest for too long, they could be deemed to accept the change. And how long is too long is always something that's just very fact dependent. I'm sure I read a case recently where somebody carried on working under protest for like over a year, and that was held to be absolutely fine, and it was accepted that they were still under protest.
Oh, okay.
I mean,
they
think,
keep saying yeah. every day, hey, I'm here, but I don't really want
yeah,
to be.
Yeah, I'm miserable. I don't agree. I don't agree. I don't agree. Yeah. And I can't remember what the, like, it was very fact specific. It was about something. It might have been about, you know, for instance, I don't know, my payment that wasn't made. I don't know. But certainly, you know, if an employee delays taking action in response to it too long, they run the risk that they've accepted it. So
it seems like less often for either party, that, like, the employer doesn't have absolute certainty over whether the new changes are in play, and probably the employee doesn't have full certainty of, you know, where they stand contractually.
What's going on?
Yeah.
No. And then you've got the grievances, etc., and all the rest of it. But, you know, what should an employer do in that situation? Well, you don't just turn around and go, well, we've implemented the change and going to handle a grievance. It's, you know, try and still talk to the employee, try to get their agreement and try to resolve matters. I mean, that's just good employee relations anyway. But yeah, I mean, so let's just assume that you impose the change, they go for constructive dismissal. That's when your process would be under the spotlight in terms of how strong were your business reasons in the first place? Did you follow a fair process in all the circumstances? So was your consultation in good faith? And that's now refer back to this code of practice as well, just to see what the consultation might look like. But yeah, I mean, then if you're not imposing them, that's when you can dismiss and re-engage, can't you?
Yeah, you're looking at dismissal and re-engagement as the option. So, you know, getting to the nub of fire and rehire. Just to reiterate, that is still lawful. It's still permitted. Yeah. What I will say is, you know, my favorite topic of 2024 is how might employment law change if there's a change in government? And you're going to hear me still talking a lot about that this year, because there may be a change in government, who knows? But Labour have been quite clear, and I checked Labour's website this morning, actually, just to see whether there was still a reference to this in light of what's been published on this code of practice. Labour are still saying they're going to end the practice of fire and rehire. So, like, question mark where that will leave us if the law changes. Because, you know, when this was first talked about in Parliament, around these rules coming in and being proposed, there was discussion around whether or not in contractual change scenarios, SOSR, some other substantial reason, so that fair reason you can rely on under the Employment Rights Act, is taken away for these sorts of exercises. So as an employer, you're not allowed to fall back on SOSR as being the fair reason in law to justify the dismissal. At the moment, you can, and that's normally what happens. You rely on some other substantial reason, and that reason is related to the business requirement as to why the change is necessary and why it needs to be made now. If that's taken away, it follows that in contractual change situations where you haven't reached agreement, but you feel you have to basically force the change through by dismissing and re-engaging, you're going to have to rely on one of the other reasons for dismissal in the Employment Rights Act, like conduct or redundancy. So that's going to be interesting to see whether there's going to be legislative change on that, say, in a year's time, if it's one of the many changes that Labour are proposing. And if you want to know more about what's on the horizon, then go back and listen to one of our episodes, I think from December or January, which you can find on Spotify and on our website. As we've said,
Can
this
I
is.
just dive in there? So
Go ahead.
that's dodgy. That's, well, not dodgy. That's sort of going to make life really difficult, isn't it? Because if you're still left with redundancy, conduct, capability, or illegality, you could end up at the point where you cannot terminate fairly, even if you've been through consultation to change somebody's T's and C's,
Not for
unless you're
SOS, well,
then
not
going
for an
to.
SOSR reason.
No, exactly. Well, there, if SOSR falls away, then you're looking at the remaining four categories, which, unless you then end up in a redundancy situation, anyway.
So yeah, I mean, just to round this off, just mindful of the time as well. So you get to the termination part of it. Obviously, if you're dismissing employees and they've got 2 years employment, you're crystallizing their ability to bring an unfair dismissal claim. So that's where the battleground will be. And like we've talked about before, that's where this code's then going to be scrutinized in terms of application, because it will be tacked on as part of the unfairness and unreasonableness in not applying the code or otherwise when compensation for unfair dismissal is looked at. But you're going to be arguing as an employer, well, we had a fair reason to dismiss, and that was some other substantial reason. We followed a fair process, so on and so on and so forth. We've had just another question as well from Mary, just asking, if you go ahead with the change, can the effective date of the change be immediate, by the end of consultation, or do you need to give contractual notice? Well, like, the normal contractual terms apply, so I think you've got the choice of, you might make a payment in lieu of notice if you've got the ability to do that, or you might serve notice, have the current contractual terms expire at the expiry of the notice period, and then the new contract starts, you know, if the employee accepts it, if it's re-engagement, afterwards.
That's, of course, if you're dismissing. But if you're consulting and you get agreement, then through the consultation process, you would agree. You'd say, this is our target date for the change to take effect. If you can get an agreement, then it will take effect on that date. So, yeah, if you haven't got agreement, then you would have to give notice to dismiss under the existing contract. There's another question there just to about when it comes into force. We did mention it up front, but just to reiterate, it's going through Parliament, and I think the guidance is that it's going to come into effect sometime in the summer. So right now it's not in force, but as we said, it's not a massive difference to the change in the law. So, just double check what you're doing in terms of your consultation processes.
I mean, if it's just been asked as an anonymous question, so if it's, I know that we've got a lot of clients joining today, and people who are not clients as well, but you're obviously all welcome. But if you're a client of ours, or indeed you want to pick our brains about something, just in terms of sense check of the process you're following at the moment, particularly with regard to the application of the tool for collective consultation stuff, then you like just get in touch with myself or Adrienne, and we can talk to you about that. So I think in terms of the takeaways today, obviously be mindful that this code of practice is coming online, and, you know, bar anything disastrous happening in Parliament, and see yesterday's scenes, but bar anything crazy happening in Parliament, these laws are going to be adopted some point in the summer. So this code is going to be adopted some point in the summer. So you need to be mindful of it in these future exercises. A lot of it is common sense, but I think one of the big things is think about your timings. basically. So think about your collective consultation process. Consider, are you going to be over 20 people that are impacted? Are the talker collective rules going to be engaged? What point are you going to start talking to people about dismissal and re-engagement as a prospect? And are you prepared to have this longer consultation period to take account of those requirements? Great. Okay.
Nothing to add.
I was going to say, stunned silence there, Adrian. Thank you to everybody that's joined today. Recording of this will be going on our website next week. As I say, check us out on Spotify and on Amazon Music and get our past episodes on there as well. We're back in a couple of weeks' time with another update. If you've got any feedback in the meantime.
Well, you are. I'm not.
Yeah, exactly. I'll be here. Adrian won't be, not for any bad reasons, but because you're going off for a couple of weeks. So it would just be me flying solo, I think. But yeah, join me in a couple of weeks' time. Any feedback on these sessions, any topics you would really, really like us to cover, then please just get in touch. But otherwise, enjoy the rest of your week. Thanks for joining.